This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There are small colleges and universities across the country that have nursing, physical therapy, even pre-med majors that cannot afford to open and maintain a cadaver lab. But there is a way for these students to get the hands-on learning they need. Introducing the SynDaver.
Synthetic cadavers mimicking the human body, so they've got very realistic tissue feel. It actually gives the students that actual hands-on sensation.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll visit a university anatomy lab to see just how lifelike these artificial bodies really are. We'll also hear how the rise in food allergies in students is changing the job of school nurses. Learn about a new center the U.S. Army is opening for children with autism, and spend an academic minute finding out if your dad's mental health can make a difference in yours. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Teaching anatomy with the use of cadavers is not limited to medical schools. There are many college majors that would benefit from having a cadaver lab on campus, but setting up and maintaining a cadaver lab is expensive, very expensive. But now students at the University of West Florida College of Health have the opportunity to gain in-depth, hands-on understanding of the human body by using synthetic cadavers. They're called SynDavers. Dr. Eric Greska is assistant professor of exercise science at UWF, and he took me for a tour of the university's new anatomy lab. Once you walk in, you see three realistic-looking bodies stripped of their outer layer. And I say outer layer because saying stripped of their skin just creeps me out. Well, they're laying out on separate examination tables in unzipped body bags. I asked Dr. Greska to talk about what exactly we were seeing.
These are SynDaver cadavers, so synthetic cadavers mimicking the human body. So they've got very realistic tissue feel. The majority of the muscles are aligned where the origin and insertion should be, as well as there's nerves running through the body. So it's an actual pretty close replication to the human body itself.
What is this used to teach?
Right now, they're actually being utilized within our functional anatomy courses, as well as within some of the nursing courses. They'll bring students over and actually teach, like, injection sites for intravenous injections, as well as I'll use them periodically within biomechanics, so that way I can actually show the students these actual principles that, you know, we really can't open up the student and start, you know, describing things happening at the muscle level or at the joint level. So it's used throughout a bunch of courses within athletic training, within exercise science, within nursing.
What does this help you do now that you couldn't do before?
It actually gives the students that actual hands-on sensation. So previously we'd give them computer programs. They can actually go in and look at the human body, but that's a 2D medium. This is now that 3D medium. So when they're actually going hands-on, they actually get a feel of where that muscle is, where the insertion may be, where the origin may be for that muscle, as well as going into the internal organs. How do they align to one another? As they palpate in there, they can actually get a feel, and then they can actually translate that to the real world when they're actually working with patients, whether it's a nurse working with a patient in the hospital, an athletic trainer working with an athlete out on the field that may have just incurred an injury.
So to get this kind of hands-on, you would have actually had to have gone to a cadaver earlier, right?
That is correct. And, you know, full cadavers, you know, the lab setup is just expensive to even get started. And then it's also acquiring the cadavers. It takes a lot of time and effort to get that up and going. And that's not to say that maybe we may not move in that direction. But at this point in time, these SynDavers are our best option. They give us the flexibility of not having to have a full cadaver lab setup. And, you know, we can just very easily insert them into our course curriculum.
We've come a long way since Resus Annie.
That is definitely true.
Is there anything on here that is not in the human body?
So there's nothing on here that is not in the human body, but as far as replicating the human body, these are not actually, you know, at the highest resolution we could have. So starting to look at the muscle insertions and origins, they have to make some type of alterations in order to get the SynDaver to kind of be one complete object. So there are things that we do explain to the students that, you know, maybe that insertion isn't exactly where it's supposed to be, or the origin isn't exactly where it's supposed to be. But it's, you know, within the ballpark, and it still gives them that initial feel. Beyond that, there are some ligaments that may not be in there because they are actually improving these SynDavers basically every year. And we're actually able to send these back and upgrade them as we move along. So it's not like we just bought this and this is what we have. We do have the ability to keep on improving the product that we acquired.
Could you point something out to me? Just anything. Show me something that, you know, you possibly couldn't have taught me a month ago without these.
Okay. Definitely. So if we actually come to the cindaver itself, so right now we actually have the internal organs displayed right now. So if you want to actually start looking at the organs, you know, right up on the top surface, we can see that right here's our liver. And then as we go below, we can start seeing the pancreas, the gallbladder, and you can see how they align to one another. And then even coming up towards the thoracic cavity, you know, we can actually open up the rib cage and you can look right into the heart. And you can actually see the aorta coming off as well as our superior and inferior vena cava coming in. So like I said, once again, it's everything is in there for the students to actually learn and see these locations and actually get a hands-on feel for the locations.
This guy's in trouble, a little fatty around the heart.
And that's what you would normally see. You know, as healthy as one could be, we do want to see some fatty deposits in there. Realize that, you know, we have to have some stored energy. It's just a matter of we don't want to see those fatty deposits inside the arteries.
So you see the internal organs, and I'm sure this is great for nursing students and medical students. What about, I know there's a physical therapy program here. Is this something that they use too?
Yes, actually. So for our physical therapy program, they've actually already taken these cadavers into their classroom to work with their students, and they've actually done some outreach with these cindavers already because they can actually put them into specific positions, and they can mimic things that the PT students would actually see throughout their careers.
Show me a hamstring, quick. I want to see a hammy.
Hamstring, you got to come over to this one.
Got to go over here.
All right, so for the hamstrings, we actually have three. So we have our semimembranosus, semitendinosus, and then this is our biceps femoris. And biceps femoris actually has two heads to it, so there is a small head right here that actually runs, that has its own origin, but then they both come into a similar insertion.
You hurt like hell sometimes, man.
Yes, they will. And there's things that go along with that. So, you know, the physiology to the hamstring as well as its location. And that's, you know, as they progress from actually learning where all these muscles have origins and insertions on the body, as they progress through their other courses. So moving on into classes like biomechanics, you know, they'll actually learn why might we incur more injuries at the hamstring compared to the quadriceps.
With something like the cindavers as opposed to a cadaver lab, I've been to some cadaver labs, and while there's a lot of education going on, it's kind of a solemn place.
It is. So, you know, when we look at it with the cindavers, this is much more of an open classroom. You know, we don't have to have that solemn, as you put it, atmosphere. In this case, we can actually have students come in. We can even invite the public in here because it's not somebody else's family member or, you know, somebody that had donated themselves to science. There is much more of an open aspect. So there's a whole lot more outreach we can do with the cindavers rather than a regular cadaver.
Smells a little better, too.
I agree. So these do not have that, you know, the common cadaver lab that would have the formaldehyde scent. These ones get stored in their own solutions, but it's a much more forgiving solution.
What do you see happening in a few years? Will you add on to this? Will there be even better models than this?
Definitely. And actually, even between these models, you'd be able to see that looking at the muscle display for one of these models versus one of the others, they actually upgraded us prior to sending them out. So they started creating one of them for us prior to an upgrade to the model. And we are able to send these back every year to allow for upgrades. So we can actually have ligaments put in the joints. As well, when we start talking about upgrading for our other professions, we will be adding a PA program here in conjunction with Florida State University. And within these cindavers, we can actually send these back and have them put anomalies within the organs. So they can actually put a tumor inside the organ, and that tumor can actually be found using ultrasound. It's amazing.
Later on, during a class in the lab, a group of students were getting acquainted with one of the cindavers. I asked one of the students, Daisy Mae Kenny, what she was playing around with.
I'm playing with the heart, actually. Actually has the veins and the arteries colored in blue, so it gives you a good visual representation of where things are going throughout the body. We have a good visual aspect of the pancreas and all the different muscles. So, you know, as a student, you see the diagrams in the textbook, but I think this really gives you a good visual as to where a thing actually articulates in the body.
Well, talking about that, what does this give you as a learning experience that you couldn't get from either projections or even maybe a real cadaver?
Being able to get hands-on and playing with it and, you know, seeing how the muscles extend and flex at each joint and being able to actually work with the cadavers is definitely better, because that when you progress into your jobs and you're actually working with real people, this is what you're working with. So being able to learn with real bodies well, virtually real bodies, gives you a good setup when you're going to be going out and working in the real world.
Real cadavers are really fragile, so you can't really get hands-on with them like this.
That second student who just chimed in is Teresa Nizguda. She actually has studied in a real cadaver lab and says, oddly, the syndavers are more realistic.
In the cadaver labs, mostly they're used over and over again, so the tissue is a drier, and it's harder to see, you know, actual landmarks because it's so dried up after it's being used, unless you're in medical school. You know, it's not as fresh. So this right here actually is more realistic.
Again, you're not going to be cutting anything here to take a look at things, but you can move everything around, though, right?
Yes, they've got – it's actually stitched to where the instructors can, if they want to open things up, certain things up, they can take the stitches apart and then put it back together again. So, you know, depending upon what structures that they're wanting to actually teach us, they can take it apart to get deeper into whatever site that they're wanting to get into. So –
what is this giving you that you couldn't get with just, you know, the projections and everything?
It's getting us a feel. You know, as an athletic training student, you know, we do a lot of palpations and things like that. And so it's really important to be able to get a feel for tissue, you know, the difference in palpating what real muscle would feel like and what it looks like underneath skin.
And it smells a lot better.
It smells a lot better than formaldehyde. Yes. Yes, definitely. You don't go home at night wanting to shower right away.
Like I said, it gives our students such a great experience, and they come out better for it. So we have the best students coming out that are going for PT programs, PA programs. Even our nursing students, our athletic training students, they come out with an actual hands-on base for knowledge rather than just something that they can open up a textbook and experience.
The syndaver is the brainchild of Dr. Christopher Sakalese, who actually appeared on the reality TV show Shark Tank last year looking for an investor. That deal didn't work out, but the company's doing just fine. Dr. Eric Greska is assistant professor of exercise science at the University of West Florida in Pensacola. You can see pictures of Dr. Greska and his students working on the syndavers on the Best of Our Knowledge page at wamc.org. The number of school-aged children in the U.S. with food allergies has been rising for years. Nationally, the rate of kids with food allergies went up 50% between the years 1997 and 2011. But in some states, like Missouri, the documented increase has been much higher. For Side Effects Public Media, Bram Sable-Smith reports on how that's changing the work of school nurses.
Pat Wilson is the lead nurse for the University City School District, just outside St. Louis. Her office is in the district's preschool building, and every day she walks down the hall, through the gym, and into a part of the school you don't really expect to find a nurse, the kitchen.
And this is our food allergy list, as you can see, it's constantly being updated.
Every morning, she checks her list of kids with food allergies to see who's going to need a special meal. Wilson's been a school nurse for 20 years. She's also president of the Missouri Association of School Nurses. And the biggest change she's seen in her profession, she says, is the rising number of food allergies.
20 years ago, I didn't see food allergies. Maybe once in a while, I may have a child with peanut allergies.
Now she has that list of students, like 4-year-old Haven Brown.
I eat some broccoli, carrots, and I eat some macaroni.
Haven knows what food she likes, and with a little prodding from her father, Joshua Brown, she also knows which foods she needs to stay away from.
Do you eat fish?
No!
Right, because what happens when you eat fish?
I get scratchy.
Right, you get scratchy, uh-huh, so we know not to eat fish, right?
Also, eggs, yeast, nuts, and some citrus fruits. And Haven is not so unusual. Through school nurses, the state of Missouri has collected health information on its students for the past 10 years. In that time, the rate of students with a life-threatening allergy has shot up by about 250%. Most of those allergies are to food.
It's hard to assess those numbers exactly because people are reporting food allergy more because they're aware of food allergy as an issue.
Marshall Plout studies food allergies at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He says while general awareness could account for some of the rise in Missouri, food allergy rates really are going up across the country.
Especially with peanut allergy, there does appear to be a true twofold increase.
One reason for the increase, Plout says, could be something called the hygiene hypothesis. Basically, we're keeping kids too clean, and not exposing them to infectious agents growing up has actually made them more likely to develop allergies. Nationally, about 2 kids in every classroom of 30 now have a food allergy. And at the same time, school nurses are seeing a rise in other chronic conditions as well. Avelia Jankowski is president of the Michigan Association of School Nurses.
3 kids with asthma in every classroom of 30, 2 kids with some sort of life-threatening allergy. I think the latest I saw for diabetes is like almost 1 in 100. I mean, our numbers are increasing.
And Jankowski says all this is reshaping the way school nurses work, focusing them more on the management of chronic conditions. For Pat Wilson back in University City, Missouri, that means she's had to make a plan for every one of her students with an allergy. She's trained their teachers on emergency procedures, like how to use an EpiPen. And every morning, she checks in with the kitchen manager to make sure students like Haven aren't exposed to the foods that can make them sick.
Do you think you really need to be this worried about allergies or food preferences of the students?
Wow, that's a good question. You know what? It's all about just keeping the children safe.
After all, she says, keeping kids in the classroom gives them the opportunity to learn. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
Still to come, the Army is opening its first center for children with autism. We'll hear about it next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The U.S. Army is planning to open its first therapy center for children with autism. The new center in Tacoma, Washington, will serve about 150 children of military personnel. It comes after years of complaints that it's nearly impossible for parents to find autism therapy while they're serving in the armed forces. For the American Homefront Project, Patricia Murphy reports.
While stationed in Germany, Army nurse practitioner Major Ruth Racine and her husband carved out a promising educational and therapeutic plan for their 7-year-old son Magnus, who has autism. During and after school, he got occupational, physical, and speech therapy.
We were in an absolutely fantastic place for my son through the Department of Defense school system. He was in a developmental program. And he had speech therapy that he was getting inside the classroom. And then we had also lined up speech therapy in the community as well as occupational therapy. And he was starting physical therapy.
But about a year and a half ago, Racine was transferred to Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Tacoma, Washington. Magnus still has some therapy in his new school, but getting the outside help he needs is a problem. Those services aren't available on base, and local therapists in the community are in high demand.
When you call the place to say, okay, great, I have my referral letter, I have my son who needs this, they'll say, okay, great, but right now we don't have room for you. We'll put you on a wait list, and you are on a wait list for 5 different places.
More than a year later, she's still waiting, and so are a lot of other U.S. military families with autistic children at bases around the world. There are 23,000 military dependents with an autism diagnosis, more than 1,000 around Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
That's definitely an issue that we do run into as a whole, I think, as a military community.
Gretchen Shea is a regional administrator for the online group American Military Families Autism Support. Her husband is in the Navy, stationed at Whidbey Island, Washington. They have 2 children with autism.
There's options there, but the wait lists are there because everybody needs either after school or there's only, you know, 1 or 2 speech therapists for a huge area.
The situation is so bad that when Penn State University conducted a survey of military spouses, about 80% say they've had difficulty obtaining services for their children. Now, next to this preschool at Washington's Joint Base Lewis-McChord, the Army plans to take a small step to address the problem. Inside this repurposed child development center will be the Army's first standalone therapy and education facility for children with autism and their families. Lieutenant Colonel Eric Flake is a doctor and the director of Madigan Army Medical Center's Developmental and Behavioral Pediatric Program.
There's going to be programs to teach parents as they have a new diagnosis. A large focus will be in some group after school type of therapy opportunities. Additionally, during the workday, this will also be a therapy center where kids will get direct speech therapy, will get direct occupational therapy.
He hopes by early next year, the center will take some of the pressure off families and help a lot of kids.
We anticipate great outcomes, ones that will be measured, ones that will be identified, and we'll be able to report those back and demonstrate that impact.
Major Ruth Racine says it'll make a big difference for her family.
My husband sent me the link for the Facebook page about the program, and tears came to my eyes immediately because as a parent, this represents hope.
But Gretchen Shea from the Military Families Group has mixed feelings about the project. The center will only serve 150 children at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. While she's happy those families will benefit some, she says the Department of Defense needs to do a lot more.
That's a great start. I do feel that it's kind of just a drop in the bucket.
Neither the Army Surgeon General's Office nor the Defense Health Agency would speculate about the future of the program. They haven't said whether they might build similar programs at other bases. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
Can the mental health of your father affect your own mental development? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How important are fathers to a child's well-being? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Claire Vallotton, associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies at Michigan State University, examines what effect being a good dad can have on your kids.
Research on parenting has long been dominated by a focus on moms, perpetuating the myth that moms are more important than dads for their children's development. One well-studied factor is the effect of moms' mental health on children's development and well-being. Young children in particular are vulnerable to these influences because their brains are growing rapidly and being shaped by experiences. Young children's most important experiences are interactions with their mothers, which are, of course, influenced by mom's mental health. So, what about dads? We decided to find out what effects, if any, dads' mental health might have on their young children's development, making sure to account for mom's mental health, since mom's and dad's mental health are correlated. We used data on more than 700 two-parent families who participated in a longitudinal study when their children were toddlers and followed them to fifth grade. First, we looked at early cognitive and language skills. Then we followed up and looked at children's mental health using a measure of early behavior problems. We found dad's stress negatively affected children's cognitive and language development, but for language, the effects were more pronounced on boys' development than on girls. Also, dad's stress and depression negatively influenced their toddler's behavior and had a lasting impact on their social skills measured in fifth grade, including hyperactivity and cooperation. Importantly, whether or not dads lived with their children, if dads were involved in their children's lives, then their mental health affected children's development. This research advances the idea that dads are vital to their children's development and well-being and should be included in research examining family influences on children. We cannot ignore the importance of men's mental health or expect men to tough it out on their own. Dads matter, so let's support their well-being and their parenting.
That was Claire Vallotton of Michigan State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.